Well, good afternoon and welcome to Williams War Games. I want to talk to you today about my solo role-playing adventure using the Old School Essentials rule set. I've managed to get four and a half days of adventuring done, some pretty exciting things, and I've already managed to create and link together a bunch of emergent narratives that have come out of procedural generation through random encounter tables and dungeon generation. So I started this journey by looking at ways to generate dungeons and how to make them more effective when role-playing solo. Because, of course, one of the major problems when you're role-playing solo is that you know that traps exist and you know that secret passages exist, but your players don't. And since you're playing as both, you either tip your hand quite a lot or you make it too easy for the player characters to determine. So I just thought I would run through some kind of mechanical exercise with an OSE party using as many rules as I could find to determine how feasible that might be. Rather than using a pre-written dungeon, which tend to have quite a emphasis on inter-player and player-to-GM narrative discussion, which obviously can't really happen when you're solo unless you're using an oracle very exclusively, I was looking at procedural generation. So historically, I've looked at the Deck of Many Dungeons, which is a deck of cards-based generating system. It's oriented around Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, so it has stats and numbers of monsters and things that are linked to that specific rule set. But if you abstract that slightly, it does provide a nice way to create dungeons, which in theory can be up to 50 cards, but in practice, or 40 cards, sorry. But in practice, they end up being fairly reasonably sized and quite easy to navigate and understand. There's a lot of data on those cards, which is useless for a solo role-playing DM/gamer because it's flavor text, which doesn't particularly lend itself to any meaningful gameplay mechanic changes. You know, it says, "Oh, this smells of rotten paper" or something, but there's nothing to. You can't draw conclusions from that. There's no treasure tables, and so you're going to have to do a lot of your own work there anyway. So I thought, if I'm going to do that, I might as well use a slightly more in-depth procedural generation process. So I had looked at the Strategic Review Volume 1, which was one of the first supplements, I believe, for the original Dungeons & Dragons, which provides a way for DMs to create dungeons ahead of time to supply to their players as in a convention setting or something, where it's all random rather than being pre-generated. It's a bit of an odd concept, really. It's not something that happens anymore, I don't think, but that was the idea. And that idea and those tables were expanded in Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition in the appendix at the back. So I used that appendix to generate a dungeon. And that was really it. So I had my dungeon. I had it stocked up with some treasure and some traps and some monsters, and that was all pretty reasonable. I created a map for it. I drew a map out based on the way the roles were going. And I got pretty much basically to the letter, really, everywhere except the second floor. So it suggests it being the appendix C in the AD&D DM guide, that lower levels become catacombs. And I thought, well, I'd quite like to have just one change in scenery for this dungeon. So I had it switching to catacombs, and then I rolled up a catacomb that's the footprint was larger than the entire rest of the dungeon put together. So essentially I linked an elevator and a spiral staircase from this upper level down to a big dungeon in a big catacomb, you know, vaulted cavern in the lower level, which contained a couple of non-player characters and a magic pool. And so with that, I decided it was time to start the actual adventure. So I rolled up some characters. So I had, and I used all dice for this, didn't swing the dice, didn't have roll 3d6 and pick the two highest or whatever. You know, I just ran it pretty much down the line. Sorry, 4d6 and dropped the lowest. I went down the line and I ended up rolling a magic user called Daphne, a thief called Kilner, a fighter called Tarwater, a cleric called Tolman. And they're pretty average in grand schemes. Probably the major factor here is they've got horrible charisma. And that's going to be an impact throughout the first few days. I rolled up their money and bought them equipment. And generally, they just had backpacks, water skins, rations, whatever immediate class requirements they had for holy water, holy symbols and spell books and crossbow bolts and things and crossbows and bows and whatnot. And I picked the spell sleep with the sorceress as a spell, because as you know, magic users level one Dungeons and Dragons, they're pretty squishy. They don't really contribute much initially. So while sleep is a bit metagamey, because of course it's a major impact, and we'll see that in due course, I found that it would balance out the comparative impact that Daphne would have on the party compared to the fighter or the cleric or whatever. I also had them roll up some retainers and hire some retainers, and I used the very specific retainer recruitment rolling process, which meant that one of the retainers ended up being 2 gold pieces and a half share, and the other was 1 gold piece a day and a quarter share of treasure. And they were both chaotic, and the rest of my party were neutral or lawful. So there was already a bit of a rift starting to form there. So the main purpose of this, as I said, was to run this dungeon. So I started them in a town, which I didn't know the name of at the time, in an inn with recruiting those retainers. And then I decided to place the town on a small hex map. So I used Wilderness Hexplore, which is I think it's a free download. I've had it for ages, from DriveThruRPG, which is really exhaustively detailed Dungeons & Dragons flavored hex generation stuff. So, you know, based on where you are, the next hex will be more likely to be the same terrain type that you're in or adjacent to it. And then in those, you have all these kinds of events and encounters and locations all within this hex, you know, and just because you have a hex doesn't mean you're going to find the major feature of it, like a castle, because these hexes are like 6 miles wide. But anyway, I managed to roll up that the town was in a plains, and the next hex across was a swamp, and the feature in that swamp was a temple, and the key feature of that temple was that it was sinking. So I thought, well, that's a fantastic lead-in to this dungeon that I've created. So I called this dungeon the Sunken Labyrinth, and it's effectively the undercroft of a temple, which existed in times long past in this swamp area before it was a swamp. And now the only thing that's remaining is this stone-cast dungeon underneath the level of the swamp, kind of slowly sinking down into the morass. I decided that it was a good idea to roll up some encounters. So being only 6 miles, that's about half a day's march, because my slowest character is in plate mail, is the fighter, and the fighter can move, I believe, 10 miles a day, but you get a 50% penalty for being in the marsh. So they got 6 miles across to get to, also 3 miles across to get to the edge of the first hex, and then at least 6 miles worth of movement in the swamp hex. So it's a good idea to roll for encounters. So OSE provides encounter tables, and I rolled up an encounter on the plains, and I got nothing. Then I rolled up an encounter in the swamp, and I ended up rolling, I think, one of the weakest swamp encounters you can have for an undead, because I rolled an undead. So you have the first table is all of the encounters that you can have in a certain type of terrain, which you then roll, and it gives you specifically what that kind of encounter might be. For example, humanoid or undead or swimming or whatever. So this is undead, and the weakest undead encounter was a ghoul encounter, and I rolled up 4 ghouls, and each of them had 4 hit points, and one had 11 hit points. So they're 2 hit dice monsters. And so there's 4 of them, so that's 8 hit dice total in theory. And a very broad way of balancing OSE, as I understand, is to compare the sum of the levels in the party to the sum of the hit dice in the monsters. So we had 2 retainers, so we had 6 hit dice on the party side, and we had 8 hit dice on the monster side. Actually, the first time I ran that combat, it was a complete massacre. The ghouls managed to close in without taking a single casualty, and then every single hit that they rolled hit, and every single amount of damage they rolled was a killing blow to every single player character. So it was just a complete annihilation. And I just reasoned that this is probably some premonition that this party have had as they're walking through these sodden swampland with grey water up to their thighs, and they're hearing the skittering of beasts just out of eyeshot. And they're thinking about the terrible fate that will befall them, and as we find out, we do encounter these four ghouls. So I run this encounter again, and I reason that this is the real one. And I think one of the major issues the first time was that when I played it, I had the encounter occur at night, and so with a torch, your at maximum range is only 30 feet. That's as far as the torch can illuminate. But of course. That means that crossbows, which have a range of like 150 feet, they can only fire once, probably, because the ghouls will be able to close the distance beyond the radius of the light quicker than the crossbowman can reload. It means that bow fire is you probably only get one shot of a bow, and you might get one or two shots with thrown daggers, depending on who gets initiative. But it was obviously not going to go well for the party. So this time I had this occur towards dusk, so I reasoned that there would be a negative modifier on shooting at long range, as expected, but then at normal range and short range they would get their standard bonuses, and there was no need for the torch to be there. Of course, ghouls are immune to sleep, so the sorceress couldn't do anything. Essentially, the thief managed to loose a couple of crossbow quarrels at that major ghoul, taking it down to 4 hit points. Daphne, the sorceress, chucked a single dagger at which managed to kill one of the ghouls outright. Their morale held, and then in the first round of actual melee combat, the thief shoved one of the retainers right into the front rank. And that retainer then took a morale test because he was being put under peril and didn't flee, but then was immediately mauled to death. And then the ghouls missed with their other attacks, and they were cut down themselves with no other casualties for the party. And that was quite a different result and quite worthwhile, I think, despite the sacrifice of one of those retainers. The party gained 22 experience points each. And one of the retainers, Wirtle, I called him, Wirtle the retainer, gains 11 experience points because he gets half of the XP, which means he goes from level 0 to level 1. And that means he needs to choose a adventuring class. So I had him choose to become a magic user because he has 16 intelligence and 14 wisdom. But I reason that we're still in the wilderness, so although he'll get the saves of a magic user, he won't know any spells, and he can continue to use his existing equipment, which was a short bow and leather armor. And that will probably be a nice plot hook for later. The party settles down for the night after that. They eat one ration each. They have half of the water skin. And Daphne, the sorceress, takes Gravit's. Gravit is the other retainer who was nobly sacrificed, takes his torches, and the fighter takes his staff and his rations. And that's the end of the first day. So that was really quite an exciting intro, and we haven't even got into the dungeon yet. The second day starts in the morning outside the dungeon, and we roll an encounter, and the encounter is for swamps, so there's like 3 and 6. So we have an encounter almost straight away with a merchant caravan. So I roll up merchants, and I get, I think, 2 merchants or 3 merchants, something like that. And then with them come dozens and dozens of bodyguards, and they're escorting a caravan of multiple wagons through the swamp. And Their reaction is wary. Both parties are in this ghoul-infested marshland, and they're very suspicious of each other, so they don't interact particularly. And the procession of merchantmen is quiet and calm, and there is nothing happening there. They are just staring at each other as they walk past. So that's an interesting plot hook as well. Like, where have these merchantmen come from, and why are they going through the marsh? Is there somewhere that's more dangerous that they're avoiding? Is there something particularly lucrative on the other side of this marsh that kind of get access to this way? Are they in league somehow with what's going on? We'll find out. And then, to be clear, I don't know what the answer to that is yet, and I will find out. But that's, to me, that's an interesting hook. So the party venture down into the dungeon, into the sunken labyrinth. And this is a dungeon of about seven or eight rooms, lots of corridors. And there's a few key events that occur in the dungeon. So I'll kind of walk us through. The Wartle, the apprentice, the new magic user, has the highest charisma and is probably a future party leader. But at the moment, he's still technically a retainer. So the decisions are going to be made by Tarwater, the fighter. And I rolled up the vice and virtue for him. And his virtue is compassion and his vice is fraud. So I'm going to use that to determine the choices that he may make during this adventure, rather than rolling the opinions of everyone. When we get to a T-junction or something, we're going to roll the dice and, you know, one to two, 3 to 4, 5 to 6, or whatever the different permutations of exit or options may be, we'll just go with that. So we have a marching order with a fighter and the cleric in front, the thief and the sorceress, who's holding a torch behind, and then the retainer right at the back with the bow. We do a lot of walking through the dungeon, exploring, and we listen at every door. We don't get any wandering monsters for quite a while. We end up in this room that's completely covered in rubble and rubbish. It's obviously been used as a dump by some temporary inhabitant of this dungeon. And as a DM, I know that there's 1,000 silver pieces and 1,000 gold pieces submerged in the kind of flotsam and jetsam of this waste and effluvium. So I have the party naturally crosses this room, and I reason that they've got no reason to investigate further. So I put an oracle question: that do they investigate further? Unlikely, and the answer is no. There's no wandering monsters. And I put another question that says, do the players come across any evidence of treasure in this room at all after having traversed it twice? So they've gone in and come out again. And the answer was no, with an exclamation mark. So they're clearly never going back, and they will miss out that treasure completely. They skip a couple of wandering monster encounters, but then they come to a T-junction, and there is monsters in the corridor. I roll up kobolds and 7 of them. So kobolds are specialists in ambush. So I only roll for surprise from the party, and I say it's a 3 in 6 chance of them getting surprised, and they don't, which I thought was interesting. So even though the party have got the lamps or the torches, sorry, and they're moving stealthily but not particularly quietly, they are not ambushed by the kobolds. And I actually did this out on some paper with 7 kobolds around a right angle corner. And it was quite surprising, really, because we had the 2 ranged fighters, the thief with his crossbow and the apprentice with his shortbow. And they shoot a couple of these kobolds down, and the kobolds immediately fail their morale test and run away. And that yields a little bit of platinum for the fighter to scoop up as a de facto leader. And no doubt they are skittering away into some hidden corner elsewhere. So the party carry on, and they come to a stage where they've got one large room with stairs up and double doors, or they've got a side passage. And they choose to go down the side passage, which leads them into a room with a spiral staircase in the middle and 3 doors surrounding the spiral staircase. All those doors are jammed shut. So they open the first door and it's empty. And they open the second door and it's empty. And they open the third door and it's locked. And so as DM, I rolled which of these doors contain something interesting and which don't. And so it was the third door that does. So they try to open the last door, and they've managed to force it open. And inside there is some treasure, but there is also a bunch of fire beetles. There's 4 fire beetles, I think. And they are pretty mean monsters. I think they got a couple of a couple of hit dice each. And the first one, they get surprise. So the Fire Beetles get a first round of combat in. And I reason that the Fighter and the Cleric are up front. And although they might not physically be able to stop the Beetles getting past them, the chances are they're going to be attacked first. So the first Fire Beetle hits the Fighter for 6 hit points, which is enough to take him down to 2 hit points. So he's really badly injured. And the second Fire Beetles miss. But they are they're clearly a major threat here. So in that second round, we have the Fighter strike back, who kills the first Fire Beetle. The Cleric strikes back and hits the second Fire Beetle. But then Daphne, the Sorceress, casts Sleep on a 10 hit dice equivalent. And all the bugs are forced to sleep and then are slaughtered completely, which means the party gains 120 XP. And in the kind of encrusted nests around where the Fire Beetles have been hanging around, there's another 1,000 silver pieces and 4 gems, which get split between the main party members. So at this point, the party don't know, but the dungeon doesn't have any more static enemies inside it, at least natural enemies behind it. So with Tarwater being incredibly badly injured, they decide that they're going to hoof it back to the town to try and get healed. So that's, and I worked it out, that's 5 turns of movement, which is 3 wandering monster checks, none of which trigger a wandering monster. And overall, that's only been a couple of hours. It's been 16 turns in the dungeon. So it's still daylight, or what passes for it, in the marshes outside the labyrinth. And they decide that they are going to head back to the town for healing. The passage of the merchantmen from earlier on is still evident. You know, all the bracken is being pushed aside, and there's ruts in the mud and things. So they are able to get on the road back towards the town. They decide to make it to dry land first, and then rest up, because it will be an overnight forced march thing. And of course, in doing so, I roll up a wandering monster encounter, and they encounter a nest of 3 giant leeches, which are incredibly deadly monsters. But luckily, we manage to get a surprise. So the party see them lurking in the murky water about 20 yards away, and they move on to drier land and manage to get past them without a danger there. And at the limits of this disgusting bog, the party rest up. On day 3, they wake up to the sound of horsemen and the clanking of weapons, and they have been surprised by a huge party of brigands, something like 2 dozen brigands, looming out of the fog about 200 yards away. Their attitude is uncaring / indifferent. Clearly, the charisma of the apprentice is now paying dividends, and most likely these brigands feel that this shabby party covered in mud with one seriously injured member is beneath their contempt completely. And maybe they've got their eyes on the merchantmen, or maybe they're in league with the merchantmen. I don't really know yet. But it's a huge force of brigands in this swamp, which is definitely, or just outside the swamp, sorry, which is definitely something that we should grab onto as a plot hook moving forward. And I want to come back to that as some threads at the end of this episode. So after healing up, the party return to the town. And now I need to figure out what this town looks like. So I called the town Andersfeld. And in Andersfeld, I rolled up that it is managed by a bailiff who is a level 1 fighter. And he can call upon 2 magic users for support in defense of the town. We already know the town must have a temple of healing because there is a way for the party to get healed there. So I've reasoned that the town is ruled effectively by the bailiff and the temple of magic, and the temple of healing is opposed to them somehow. I rolled up that the village is vaguely uneasy, and in addition to these 2 temples, it has a market hall and some shops. And most relevant to this discussion is the shops have, there's a slave market there, and as well as a regular shop and a coaching inn. So I reason that that there is something really off in this town. But for now, at least, we managed to get back to the town and attend this temple of healing, donate one gold piece for every use of cure light wounds, and that restores our missing hit points from our fighter. And they rest overnight at the inn, cost another couple of gold coins, and they ponder the events of the day. So day four starts, and we're at the coaching inn in Andersfeld, and the party is now Tolman the cleric, Tarwater the fighter, Daphne the sorceress, Kilna the thief, and Wirtle the apprentice. And my gut feeling is here that the amount of money that the party managed to retrieve, which was in the thousands of silver pieces, is enough to tempt Wirtle to continue to join them. He doesn't have a spell book yet, and he's not a magic user. My sorceress, Daphne, does have paper and pens and could maybe try and teach him, but I think that's better done as a quest. So I'm just going to keep him exactly as it is. And there's a couple of plot hooks that I can use to expand. So I had three options here. One was the apprentice seeks knowledge of these ethereal forces. So does he go to the Temple of Magic? Is he aligned with the Temple of Magic? You know, does he want to? He's chaotic. The rest of the party are neutral or lawful. So is he an outsider? Or what's going on there, basically? Do we pull the thread of Wirtle the apprentice? Then the fighter and the thief both want to return to the Sunken Labyrinth to finish off that delve. They don't know what else is there, but they rightly assume that there's not much more to explore there, so they may as well finish it off. And the third option is the cleric and the sorceress want to further investigate the merchants and the brigands. Should we find out what's going on with the merchants? Should we, talk to the people running the town? Shall we go and seek out the brigands and find out what's going on with them? So that's what they do. The bailiff who runs the town is very suspicious of newcomers, and so they decide they have to make a choice now. So they decide, rolling the dice, they decide to go back to the Sunken Labyrinth, and they find one more retainer who accepts one gold piece a day, plus the cost of his backpack rations and water skin, another 7 gold, and a half share in the treasure. So they don't need to buy any more rations yet, and they have water available, so they just crack on. No monster encounters in the road or in the swamp. They enter the dungeon, and it's only been a day. It's only been like 24 hours, 36 hours, so they don't need to worry about the dungeon being restocked particularly. We have the fighter and the elf up front, then the cleric and the sorceress in the middle, the thief and the apprentice behind. And so one of the things that we didn't discover in that first delve was that off of the entrance to the dungeon, there is a room that contains like half a dozen dwarfs who are there. And we don't know why they're there, but they're there. And they're lawful and they're friendly and so on. So there's no expectation that we'd be fighting them. But we ask the oracle, are they still there? And the answer is yes. And so we then say, do the party backtrack straight to that spiral staircase room with the three little cubby holes around the side? And the answer is yes. So we have another 5-turn, 310-foot or so movement to get back to that position. And so we have a couple of wandering monster rolls, which don't happen. But then, just as we're getting to that room, we roll on the monster encounter chart and we get orcs. And we get lots of orcs. And with the reaction modifier, NPC modifier for charisma by Wirtle the Apprentice, their attitude is indifferent and uninterested. So why are these orcs indifferent to the presence of the player characters? It's clearly like a magical, unearthly dungeon. This isn't the orcs' home. So they must be mercenaries for someone deeper in the dungeon, potentially, or they've been sent elsewhere to find out what's going on. Do they know about the dwarves already? Is that what they're going for? Are they competing adventuring parties and we are nothing compared to them? So the party kind of get out of the way as the orcs shoulder past. And I asked the Oracle, does the party attack the orcs with surprise in the rear as they go past? And I put that as likely, but the Oracle came back with no. So my party sits there and doesn't do anything. And as their party continue onwards, they hear the sound of grunting and screaming and clashing of metal as those orcs run into those dwarfs right by the entrance to the dungeon. And the party descend the spiral staircase into the cave-like catacombs below. They send the thief down first, sneaking down the stairs without a torch and moving away from the party. So the idea being that then he can potentially move in shadows and move silently and hide in shadows and things. We'll see how that goes. And we roll for some monitoring encounters and there is nothing, but we can hear the sound of chanting and a faint blue light. So I roll for surprise, and the chanting people are surprised. And so they're visible at 110 feet. That's the encounter distance I put down there. So most things are out of range, apart from magic and very long ranged fire. So we have the sorceress dousing their own torch. So now the party are reliant on the light provided by this ritual that's going on, and it means that they can't easily be seen. The thief takes a shot with his crossbow at normal range and misses. The apprentice takes a shot with his short bow and, in a complete fluke, manages to hit one of those mediums, and it's the only medium that has an offensive spell, which is magic missile, and takes him down in one go, which is just quite incredible, really. The elf retainer decides to cast light on the last remaining medium to blind them, but the medium saves versus spells and it has no effect. The two melee fighters, the cleric and the fighter, just advance forward 20 foot or so. So it's going to be some time before they get into combat. That second medium who saved against the light spell fails their morale throw and flees into the unknown depths of the cave. So that's kind of a bit of anticlimax there, really. The sorceress relights the torch. The party gain 85 gold pieces, 16 experience points, and an unknown potion. Now, I know, as GM, this potion is poison. So we've got to figure out how we're not going to immediately kill ourselves with that. The party has to advance that distance to collect their loot, which they do without a monster encounter, and then I ask the Oracle if that second medium, the one who ran away, rallies for another fight or not. And the answer was no, they do not. So they have squirreled themselves into some unknowable corner of this vast cavern underneath the swamp, and they are staying well out of it. The only other features, other than in the cavern, other than those nooks and crannies, is a pool, which is by those spiral staircase in the opposite direction from the way we moved. So I ask the Oracle if the party head for it, and they do. So they have to move quite a distance to get back to it. So that's another monster encounter, and they don't get anything. And it's giving off a pale glow. And so Daphne the Sorceress walks in, and it turns out to be a magic pool that can add or subtract 1 to 3 points from a random stat, and they gain +2 dexterity, which keeps them in the normal range anyway, so nothing to really shout about. The other party members are pretty reluctant because their key stats are what they need to be, really. You know, the cleric has high wisdom, the fighter has high strength, and so on. So the only one who's willing to walk in is the elf retainer, and he loses one constitution. And so, yes, after 4 turns of exploration, they get back to the dungeon entrance, requiring a couple of monster rolls, which don't do anything, and they find the blood and gore splattered side entrance, which was leading to that dwarf room. And so I said, do the party investigate? And I think it's fairly likely, and the answer is yes. So 5 dwarves have been massacred by the orcs, who themselves are cut down to their leader and 2 lackeys. So the orcs are surprised, and so Daphne, the sorceress, casts sleep and sleeps them all, and the party just murders them while they stand there. They retrieve some of the dwarf weapons. They take some crossbows and crossbow bolts, and there's a number of dwarven coffers that have been stashed in that room, or the coffers, I don't know where they're from, but they're coffers full of silver and platinum. So the party take those as well. And it's been another couple of hours in the dungeon. They decide to get out while the going is good, sleeping rough in one of the driest parts that they can find outside the dungeon. And on the way back, so the next day when they try and make it back, the merchantman path is gone. So they have to roll to get lost, and they're okay. Then they have to roll for monsters, and they're also okay. They make it the way back onto dry land, and one final wandering monster check, and they're okay for that. And they arrive back in the coaching inn in time for some sour ale and gristly meat. And that is the end of the adventure. So I managed to roll up, like I said, these threads. So we have these mediums in the Sunken Labyrinth. You know, are they employed by the Temple of Magic? There are two magic users that I rolled up there, Alaraine and Cordell. And maybe one of those is somehow linked to these mediums. They had the merchants and brigands. You know, are they a benign merchant convoy? And then the bandits are hostile. Maybe we go with the merchants and the bandits are waiting in ambush. Or maybe we work with the merchants and we decide to betray them to the brigands eventually. You know, there's a lot to happen there. You know, do we run combat? Do we just abstract it? But there's stuff going on there. And what about this uneasiness in Andersfeld? You know, why are they uneasy? Is it something to do with the Temple of Magic? You know, is this a you know, bait and switch? Are the Temple of Magic the good guys, or are they the bad guys? Because I've rolled up one of those magic users, and they have the spell Charm Person. So maybe actually the bailiff isn't using them; they're using the bailiff. And I'm kind of inclined to think that's an interesting thread to pull up. At least until we get a bit further. So that's been my first few sessions of running Old School Essentials as a solo role-playing adventure. I've been using Obsidian as a tool for this, which is definitely a usable tool, and I wonder how much of it is a bit of a false friend, because you can do lots of cross-referencing and linking. So if I go to one of my journal pages, then I can literally reference each character, so I can click on them at any time. I can click on the maps and click on references to places and previous days. So I can do lots of that. But I don't know how much of that is just, it looks really cool, but actually I never actually use it or not. But it definitely feels like it's more structured than the paper journaling that I've done. I mean, kind of part of the reason I started to do solo roleplay was to get me off of the computer, and I'm finding myself on it even more doing it like this. So we'll have to see long term. But anyway, that's what I've been doing, and I hope that's been enjoyable. I've got a big choice, really, on what happens next. You know, do we immediately go into some conflict with the Temple of Magic now that the mediums have been killed and that last one escaped, and maybe they managed to run through the night and warn the town, maybe? Or do we encounter the bandits again? Do we seek out the bandits and see if we can make some filthy lucre? So I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts and opinions on what I've done, how I've done it. And this is my first time recording a podcast like this about this subject. So if you have any thoughts about the format or the way that I'm doing things, I would be really interested to know. I'd really appreciate it. Thank you very much, and I will speak to you soon.